Hi, everyone. We have a little bit of everything today. Robberies, bank fraud, narcotics trafficking, arson, and even massage parlors.
Well, and we have some very familiar names, Mercurio, Bianco, Patriarca, to name a few, plus some we haven't covered yet, Joseph Puzzangara and Mickey Napolitano and his son, Little Joe.
We won't be getting to Puzzangara until next week for sure, and come to think of it, the massage parlors will probably have to wait too, I suspect. Trying to keep a promise that we made to our listeners. This episode was inspired by an email from one of our listeners, so instead of a mailbag Q&A, we have this episode today. We always joke that all roads lead to Maine, because it appears that Dad was constantly feeding the feds information about Maine going back to the mid-1960s, and as odd as it may sound, Maine was a safe haven for all sorts of wise guys, including Orlando, Michael, Mickey, Napolitano.
Think about it. How many guys took it on the lam there? Jimmy Flemmy, for one.
Yeah, and wasn't Johnny Mutterano bringing Jimmy Flemmy like care packages up in the woods there?
That's what I've been told. So I've heard. Richie sent them on wild goose chases up there. Vinny Teresa and the... Was it the Jade in... From there?
The jade was from Maine, too. The jade and the ivory thing that ended up on Cape Cod was stolen from Maine. So Maine was a happening place, but there was also an official, so to speak, mob presence there in the form of Mickey Napolitano. And before that, there was his dad, Joseph Big Joe Napolitano, who in 1924 was slinging morphine in Portland.
And there was Mickey's son, Little Joe Napolitano, too.
And who could forget Little Joe? And the family is still in Portland and highly respected members of the community. I was reading a lovely tribute to one of the grandsons who passed away a few years ago.
And one of Mickey's other sons was also a very prominent, highly respected member of the community. So it's nice to see the chain broken. And after all, isn't that the point? You hustle to give your kids a better life so they don't have to suffer.
Exactly. It isn't always the case, but it should be. Okay, before we get started, I know you have something that you want to get off your chest.
Okay, well, it seemed appropriate to bring this up given the content of this episode because we keep mentioning intel laundering. Recently, we've been looking at part of Richie's informant file and the notes made by the U.S. Attorney's Office from 2002. There are notes in the margins about a handful of statements that Richie told the authorities he didn't make. Statements that the other authorities also felt weren't made by Richie as they refused to prosecute him. Even Special Agent Larkin, one of Richie's early handlers, along with H. Paul Rico, said in sworn statements that he did not recall hearing Richie make those comments. And there are other instances in those same 302s where Rico attributes statements made by C.V. Flemmy directly to him as coming from a different unidentified informant. These are just small examples of it, but on multiple occasions, we have seen information inserted into the news that were Rico's personal opinions or information illegally obtained via the wiretap or some other unsanctioned source, or sometimes just flat-out fabrications.
In this episode, we will see numerous instances of it in relation to Napolitano's story specifically. We've seen this in other non-mob-related research we've done over the years, too.
Well, I remember first coming across it about a decade ago when I was looking at the WikiLeaks. I quickly realized that the process worked something like this. Someone in the government would leak information to Reuters, for example, and then that same information would find its way back into their intelligence reports.
And then the journalists would run with the story, typos and all, and no one would bother to verify even one sentence of it. You'd see 10 news sources. But the exact same story over and over, and we still see it to this day. It's the approved narrative loose out there in the wild on the damages dock.
Exactly. It happens every single day.
Screaming, roaring success story.
So back to the feds version of it. So when we started looking at the views from the FBI, it quickly became clear that they were doing something similar. In many cases, it's unclear if the information is from a live source or if it's from the wiretaps. The lines were very, very blurred. I would say deliberately so, because many, if not most, of the wiretaps were illegally installed. They could then launder the intel just like illegal funds, and that's how we came up with the phrase intel laundering as kind of a play on the idea of money laundering.
And we'll dig deeper into this when we get to Jerry Angiulo's wiretaps.
Well, that's true, because we recently discovered that it is highly likely that the wiretap at Jerry's in the 60s was also illegally installed.
And it's very interesting that Dad submitted his affidavit to the Senate Committee on Organized Crime and Narcotics in March of 1965. And the feds got wind of it in April of 65. And Rico and Larkin swore out statement. The committee released their findings, including the illegality of the federal wiretaps. And like magic, the wiretap was disabled at the coin-o-matic. I'm not saying that Dad had anything to do with that, but the feds knew their illegal wiretap days were numbered.
And that's why they needed to watch the information that they were gleaning from the wiretaps. Okay, I'm putting away the soapbox, getting off of it, and we'll jump into the Napolitanos.
Okay. Orlando Michael Mickey Napolitano was born in 1916 to Lena Grimaldi and Joseph Napolitano.
Hold on a minute. Not to be too pedantic, but while Mickey's obituary says that he was born in Brooklyn, New York, I did find a birth certificate stating that he was born in Portland, Maine.
That makes perfect sense. And as I mentioned earlier, his father, Joseph, was one of the major narcotics dealers in the state of Maine. In 1924, he reportedly sold an ounce of morphine to a federal agent in a sting operation.
You know, I think this is one of the earliest sting operations I've ever read about.
Likewise, and it must have been insane. Big Joe weighed 225 pounds, and he wasn't going to let the law take him in that easily, so they shot him three times in the hand, the thigh, and the leg.
Can you imagine?
No.
So I haven't been able to find a photo of him, but his World War I draft card described the then 30-year-old as tall, stout, and slightly balding. So that's the description of what Big Joe looked like. Big Joe ended up in the local hospital, chained to his bed with an armed guard outside the door. 5 months later, Big Joe was found guilty on the charge of selling drugs, but not on the charge of resisting arrest. In the meantime, the authorities discovered that Napolitano was not a U.S. citizen, despite reportedly having lived in the U.S. for 2 decades, so they started proceedings to have him deported.
Of course, he appealed, but the conviction was upheld, and he was ordered to appear before the court to be sent to the federal pen in Atlanta for 1 year and a day in November of 1925, a full 18 months after his arrest. But by that time, Big Joe had packed up his family that now numbered a wife and 7 children, and they headed off to Brooklyn, and they took it on the lam there for 11 years.
That's insane.
But think about it. It was the perfect place to hide.
Well, that's true. Family, large family. They had five more kids
after that?
Yeah.
12?
Yeah, he had a kid and even dozen kids.
Wow.
Okay. Anyway. By the early 30s, the now-grown Mickey Napolitano had made his way back to Maine, where he started his life of crime, mostly for what was euphemistically called liquor violations in the papers. He married a local girl, and they started a family, with Joe Napolitano being the eldest son, named after his narco-grandfather. During World War II, Mickey served in the Navy in the Pacific Theater. While he was gone, Big Joe passed away. Mickey was released from service and became a civilian again in December of 45. The Navy had failed to reform him, however, and he picked up where he left off with his criminal enterprises. He avoided any serious charges, and most of his pinches were for gambling and such stuff.
In January of 1964, he was arrested by the FBI on racketeering charges. The specific allegation was that he had a packet of betting slips that he handed to a driver who had then transported them across state lines into Massachusetts and on to Boston. He was sentenced to 2 years in a federal court in Boston in June that same year.
Yeah, this timing's super interesting, actually. I wonder if they got the intel off the wiretap at Jerry's.
Well, it's certainly possible. You're right about the timing, for sure. In June of 1968, this one doesn't make any sense to me, actually, Mickey was arrested for stealing $200,000 worth of merchandise from a jewelry store in Manchester, New Hampshire. The cops acted quickly and recovered most of the loot in Mickey's car. 7 months later, he pleaded guilty and was sentenced the following January to 30 months to 10 years in prison.
Well, it's almost like they knew he was going to do it before he did it. You know what I mean? Like, almost like it was a setup. Interesting. But why is the timing so broad there?
Well, because
on the sentence?
It's one of those things like you get 25 to life. It's really not that odd. It's an effort to keep the person on parole for extended periods of time. So if the person doesn't wrap up that lower number of the sentence and is granted parole, they're on parole for the balance of the years to the higher number.
So
So if he gets out after doing, say, 2 years, then he's going to be on parole for another 8 years.
Well, let's introduce little Joe Napolitano now. In May of 75, he was arrested on counterfeiting charges. He didn't have much of a record prior to that arrest, but had been convicted in late 62 on charges of operating an illegal still in Maine, along with several others in New England. The IRS claimed in court that the group had been producing several thousand gallons of alcohol weekly and distributing it along the East Coast for about 7 months.
That must have been a mega still.
For sure, but get this. They were arrested on March 24th, 1962, just 18 days after the wiretap was installed at the Coin-O-Matic in Providence. The Boston FBI office does not appear to have been involved in this at all, though, and no mention of it is made in the notes from the wiretap.
It's still awfully suspicious, and I could see the Fed giving, you know, a heads up to the ATF or the IRS.
Sure, but I don't think the Napolitanos were with Raymond as much as they were with New York, which makes sense given that Big Joe had been living in Brooklyn for 11 years.
True, but that doesn't mean the boys didn't know about the still and weren't gossiping about it.
Well, for sure, especially since there were Providence guys involved in the operation. Yeah. But I still have questions about the story that Larry Bioni made little Joe, given the Napolitano's New York ties. That just seems highly improbable.
I'll go on my tirade about that later.
I don't know. I just think they're maybe more tied in with New York and slash, you know, like at the New Haven situation.
Yeah, well, definitely the Connecticut situation is tied to New York. And the same thing with Western Massachusetts, too. Springfield. Like Schiavelli and all those guys. Okay. Sorry.
Well, in the meantime, little Joe was sentenced to 3 years in prison in January of 69, along with Sammy Rosencrantz of Newton, Massachusetts, who drew the heaviest sentence, and Frank Romano and Charles White of Providence, Joseph Alamonte and Anthony DePietro, also Massachusetts residents, and John J. Ricci of Portland, Maine.
And I wonder if John Ritchie is somehow related to the Joe Ritchie who ended up labeled as a monster. Do you remember that video? I think it was the 60 Minutes video that our listener who sent this whole thing about Napolitano included in that email.
Probably. But you're talking about the guy who had the rehab residence thing for the troubled rich kids, right?
Yeah, that's the one where Michael Skakel was a patient and he supposedly confessed to killing Martha Moxley there.
Okay, we're not going to go down that rabbit hole today. But we should mention that Ritchie had finagled his way into this next case, not to inform on the Napolitanos, but to continue to carry out Jack's revenge plan on Vincent Costa, who some of our listeners will remember as one of the perpetrators of the Brinks heist.
Oh yeah, so Jack and Dad love the long game. There's no question there. But let's talk about the case itself for now. In May of 1975, little Joe was arrested in Revere with two large green suitcases filled with counterfeit bills.
They were stuffed in the trunk of a Thunderbird driven by little Joe's cousin, Michael. A total of 11 people were arrested in Chelsea, Massachusetts and Los Angeles, California. Besides little Joe and his cousin, Michael, Felice Napolitano, Pasquale Napolitano and Vincent Costa, six others were taken into custody from around the country. The $1 million worth of $20 bills were printed by a counterfeiter that Costa had a relationship with. The Secret Service described the ring as one of the biggest in New England. As Lara mentioned, we suspect that Ritchie had given the authorities information on what Vincent Costa was up to after he got out of prison.
Correct. And a few months later, in October of 1975, an unknown informant told his handler that Costa had stiffed the counterfeit printer for his work. Although the authorities initially said they had printed roughly 1 million worth of counterfeit bills, the number was actually closer to 2.5 million.
That's crazy.
Yep.
I think the unknown informant is Ritchie, though.
I do too, but...
So funny. But while awaiting trial, little Joe was shot twice in the stomach at 2:15 in the morning on December 28th while parked on Federal Street in Boston. He said a man approached his vehicle, opened his car door, and opened fire before fleeing on foot. Which sounds highly suspect, in my opinion, but...
It's Boston.
Little Joe was unable or unwilling to provide a description of his assailant, but was able to drive himself to the hospital before losing consciousness.
The counterfeit trial against Joe Napolitano began in September of 1976. Felice Napolitano had already been sentenced to 3 months after pleading guilty in an agreement in which he told Judge Toro that he was promised that the government wouldn't seek further charges against him. Judge Toro held him on contempt charges after he refused to testify for the second time.
And the following day, Little Joe was found guilty. He was scheduled to be sentenced on October 14th, but Judge Taro imposed a 2-year suspended sentence after finding D.A. Jeremiah O'Sullivan's claim that Napolitano was a counterfeiting kingpin ridiculous.
O'Sullivan tried to submit 2 affidavits from the Secret Service, but Taro rejected them. He did offer a continuance to allow O'Sullivan to gather witnesses to put on the stand, who would also be subject to cross-examination, but O'Sullivan declined.
Okay, but the counterfeiting ring was not out of commission, according to the authorities. And I'm sorry, but I find this next part of the story really fishy and weird. Forgive me. Mm-hmm. In May of 1977, 3 Dedham residents were arrested on charges of larceny over $100. There was just a brief little blurb in the newspaper that the trio had been arrested by the Jordan Marsh security police. So, like, the Jordan Marsh had their own?
All the department stores had security. I worked at Filene's when I was, you know, a teenager. They weren't police necessarily, but they could stop you, you know, take you in. They'd bring you down to a room or whatever and then hold you until the actual police came. It's not like now where you can go stop living. Walk out with half the store and nobody can stop you. Back in those days, they could still stop you.
Yeah.
But only thing I think of is Jordan Marsh and the blueberry muffins. I'm sorry.
We need a Boston organized crime food tour. That's what I think. Even if it's just a virtual one.
I think that would be kind of cool to put together. When we go on our season break between season 2 and season 3, then we'll do that.
If we ever get to the end of season 2.
Season 2 is just going to go on for another 2 years, but that's okay.
Well, for 2 months, there wasn't even a peep about the Jordan Marsh case until the home of one of the men, James B. Shapiro, was raided by the Secret Service and the Norfolk Sheriff's Department. In his bedroom closet, the feds found more than $3 million worth of counterfeit $100 bills. The Secret Service agent in charge was the same agent who was in charge of the Napolitano case, Thomas C. Smith. The following month, Shapiro and his cohort, Lee F. Atherton II, appealed their larceny sentences for the theft at Jordan Marsh.
And that seems ridiculous considering what they were facing. 3 months later, in September, both Mickey and little Joe were arrested. Mickey was picked up in Florida and Joe in Maine at his mom's home.
I just want to mention that Sonny Mercurio, Richie Floramo, and Philip Corso were arrested in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on stock fraud charges the exact same day.
The 70s and 80s were the decades of bank, security, loan, and stock fraud. We could do a whole series just on that.
It's true, and it was much easier than robbing, I suspect, at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, Little Joe faced charges on 2 counts of conspiracy to possess and for passing counterfeit money.
And here's where it gets crazy. Well, in Massachusetts, here's where it gets normal.
Well, got nothing to say to that, but according to John Zip Connolly's testimony in April of 78, it was little Joe Napolitano who had led them to Shapiro's home, and Napolitano gave Connolly samples of the counterfeit money that Zip then passed on to the Secret Service on June 29th. That evidence was what allowed them to get a warrant to raid Shapiro's home.
Secret Service agent Gerard Bellevue claimed that Connolly introduced him to Napolitano as an informant on July 5th, 1977, 3 days before Shapiro's home in Dedham was raided. A Boston police officer who was on Garrett Burns' staff stated he met Napolitano at the Parker House in Boston 3 days after the raid. Quote, "This is a bizarre case. This is the first time I've ever participated in identifying an informant in court," end quote. Connolly testified after him that he was informed by Burns' organized crime task force the following day that he had to drop Napolitano as an informant.
All of it makes me want to scream.
More like it makes you want to punch someone.
Hey, I'm not that kind of girl.
I am.
3 weeks later, Connolly stated Napolitano called him to set up a meeting. But Connolly says that he refused, and then he claims that he made no promises to little Joe Napolitano.
Oh, how familiar.
Hello. Zip said he told Napolitano that he would be outed as an informant, but it was never made clear when Connolly supposedly told him that, only that Connolly states it under oath at the trial that Little Joe didn't show up for.
Meanwhile, the Boston sack for the Secret Service, Thomas Smith, said that the investigation into the counterfeiting had been ongoing for 2 months, exactly the amount of time that had elapsed from the time Shapiro was pinched for the theft at Jordan Marsh.
Honestly, my money is on Shapiro or his wife or one of their partners slipping, not Little Joe. It all screams of Fed intel laundering and Connolly doing a favor for Whitey or just going after the Italians as usual. My other kinder theory is that Connolly threw Napolitano to the sharks to protect Sonny Mercurio as a source. Just reminding you guys that Sonny had been a top echelon informant for over a decade at this point in the story. So he was pretty, you know, high level and pretty immersed in the whole thing.
And he was in trouble at that point in time. So he gets arrested the same day that all these other guys get arrested. So you're not going to get an argument out of me. Okay, let's wrap up the Shapiro counterfeit case. The Suffolk County ADA demanded that the judge revoke the now AWOL Little Joe's bail, who had fled after the first day of the trial. According to him, Little Joe had threatened to flee the country if he were indicted, but the judge waited until after the weekend to decide, and by that time, Napolitano was gone. Connolly had taken the stand again and said that Joe could lead him to another $10 million in counterfeit loot and had given him two $100 bills as proof.
So good old attorney Harvey Brower, who was defending Little Joe, told the court that he couldn't have been both a conspirator and an informant. He said that his client fled because he knew the feds were going to state in open court that he was an informant. The jury began deliberating against Joe and Ethel Rotondo Shapiro, the wife of James Shapiro, on April 13th. After 3 hours of deliberations, the jury returned guilty verdicts for both Joe and Ethel. Then on April 19th, 1978, Shapiro and Orlando Mickey Napolitano were given 3 to 5 year Walpole sentences in exchange for pleading guilty. Okay, now let's skip ahead to the real tragedy of the story.
On Wednesday, September 6, 1978, Little Joe Napolitano and John Jackie Giannone were found murdered in the trunk of a rental car at an intersection in Queens, New York. The neighbors reported the car parked there, and the rental company sent someone to pick it up, only to discover the bodies of Little Joe and Jackie. This, in my mind, confirms my theory that they were affiliated with the Colombo family and not Raymond and Jerry. It was rumored that Little Joe turned to the Columbos for help, but whether they were whacked by the Columbos or by Boston, getting there first, that's a mystery.
Well, the reporting made me crazy. They tried to say that Little Joe asked the feds to reveal that he was an informant and that he was made by Ilario Zanino, aka Larry Bayoni, and served as a lieutenant in Raymond Patriarca's family. They also wrote that some of the wise guys knew for years that he was an informant and that the wiretap that Burns had running caught some of them on tape saying Little Joe had a big mouth.
And then they tried to drag Nicky Bianco into it. They reported that he was now the now deceased Joe Colombo's right-hand man all that time. And we get another version of how Nicky was made.
Yeah, what version of the number is this?
Version number, I don't know, 3 or 5. I can't even keep track anymore. But it's going to get your dander up, I can guarantee you. They said that according to the wiretap at the Coin-O-Matic, Raymond sponsored Nicky to be made in September of 1963 and that he sent him to New York for it to happen.
But the books were closed.
Well, someone forgot to tell the feds that. They also reversed the story about Nicky going to Rhode Island at the behest of Gallo to ask Raymond to help smooth things out in the Gallo Profaci War. Didn't we just cover that the last episode?
Yeah, and I thought it was the opposite. I don't know.
No, it was the opposite. But they said instead that Raymond sent Nicky to New York on his behalf, so that Nicky was living in Rhode Island at that time, not in New York. And that instead of Nicky going down at the behest of Gallo to have Raymond help make the peace, and remember that whole thing where they have on the tape that Raymond tells Nicky to put the gun in the barber shop and all that, because Nicky was going back to New York that night because Nicky was living in New York.
Well, talk about fake news. My head hurts, and that is absolutely intel laundering. But like most of the other homicides we've covered, the murders of Little Joe and Jackie Giannani remain unsolved. Now, before we break our promise again, let's wrap it up today, and we'll return next week with the massage parlors, Jerry Angiulo, Joe Puzzangara, and so much more.
I'm happy to keep at least one of our promises. One promise? One? Only one? Ah. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Bye.
Bye.